Welcome to Food Psych, a podcast dedicated to critiquing diet and wellness culture and answering your questions about intuitive eating and the anti-diet approach. I'm your host, Christy Harrison, and I'm a registered dietitian, certified intuitive eating counselor, journalist, and author of the books Anti-Diet, The Wellness Trap, and the new Emotional Eating, Chronic Dieting, Binge Eating, and Body Image Workbook, which are all available wherever you get your books or at ChristyHarrison.com/books. That's ChristyHarrison.com/books. And by the way, on this show, we avoid diet culture details like weight and calorie numbers, but we don't censor swear words or other adult language, so listener discretion is advised. Hey there. Welcome to this episode of Food Psych. I'm Christy, and today I'm talking with dietitian and author Heidi Schuster for her third appearance on the pod, all about kids and helping them develop a peaceful relationship with food. We talk about why putting kids on gluten-free diets or other elimination diets in the name of health often backfires, how parents can help kids develop a good relationship with all foods, including demonized ones like sugar, developmentally appropriate ways to talk to kids about nutrition, which, hint, are very limited, why pleasure is actually more important than nutrition, and so much more. This was a great conversation, and I can't wait to share it with you. First, I want to let you know about a couple of resources that you might find helpful if you're listening to this podcast, one of which is my new book, The Emotional Eating, Chronic Dieting, Binge Eating, and Body Image Workbook, which I co-authored with therapists Judith Matz and Amy Pershing, who are longtime friends of the pod, as well as leaders in the field of diet culture recovery, binge eating disorder, and trauma-informed care. I'm so honored to work with them, and we joined forces to create this workbook because we wanted to help readers break free from the diet binge or restrict rebound cycle, recognize sneaky diets disguised as wellness plans, better understand the role food plays in your life and in managing emotions, unlearn the harmful messages about what and when you're quote-unquote supposed to eat, dispel myths about weight, health, and fitness, and so much more. If any of that sounds interesting to you, you can learn more and buy the book at ChristyHarrison.com/workbook or click the link in the show notes. I also wanted to let you know that Intuitive Eating Fundamentals, which is the online course I created and launched way back in 2016 to help you make peace with food, is now open for enrollment. The course teaches you how to recognize and reject diet culture, take pleasure in food and stop fighting your desires, tune back into your body's signals of hunger and fullness, end the restrict rebound cycle, navigate emotional eating and learn new coping skills, and most importantly, perhaps, avoid turning intuitive eating into a sneaky diet. Sign up for instant access to hundreds of hours of supportive content, including 13 modules on the principles of intuitive eating, deep dives into how to handle common things that come up when you're trying to make peace with food, and a live monthly Q&A to help answer all your questions. This cohort also includes a special members-only forum to help you connect with others and support each other through the course, and alumni get free access to future forums as well. You can learn more and sign up at ChristyHarrison.com/course, or just click the link in the show notes. Now, without any further ado, here's my conversation with Heidi Schuster. Heidi, welcome back to Food Psych. I'm so excited to talk with you today.
I'm so excited to be here, Christy. Thanks for having me yet again.
Thanks for coming back yet again. We last spoke in 2018, which is 6 years ago as we're recording this, for your first book, Nourish. So can you catch us up on everything you've been up to since then?
Well, how much time do you have?
No.
I've just been busy, as always, with my practice. And I did some training in somatic experiencing since then, which has been really mind-blowing for my practice. And I have been working on this second book, which just came out in January of this year. So it's been a busy time.
Yeah, book launches are always quite hectic, I know. So tell us about this book. It's called Nurture, How to Raise Kids Who Love Food, Their Bodies, and Themselves. What inspired you to write this?
Lots of things. Well, I have two daughters myself who are somewhat featured in the book, and luckily they are adults at this point and able to give permission for all of their stories to be in print. And I'm grateful for that. So as a parent, I have been obviously really interested in, you know, how to prevent more problems with eating and body image in the next generation. And then as a provider, as a clinician, I had so many people approach me after reading my first book and say, I wish that I had this information when my kids were younger, or I wish that my parent had this information. And, you know, I've been encouraged to try to write something for parents and caregivers from that perspective, both as a parent and a clinician. So here I am. That was sort of my inspiration, among other things.
Let's get into what is included in the book. You have 10 steps. You say they're not necessarily steps that have to be practiced in order or like rigid in any way, but they're kind of 10 principles for raising a kid with a positive relationship with food in their body. Can you just give us a quick overview of what the steps are?
Sure. And you're absolutely right, Christy. They're definitely not linear. The first step is related to letting go of dieting for both yourself and your children. The second step has to do with speaking well of bodies, being respectful and speaking well of bodies, including your own. I say your children may look like you someday. Step number three is about how we provide food for children and work on avoiding deprivation, which is something that I know you've talked about frequently here. Step four is related to building self-regulation skills in young people. Obviously, we sometimes have to work on them ourselves as adults. Step five is a little bit more about nutrition, but I highlight pleasure as actually more important than nutrition when we're particularly talking about food with young people. Step six is about encouraging conscious movement for your family. I say joyful movement, and obviously not everyone has a joyful experience of movement in their particular body. I don't want to be ableist in the way I'm speaking about this, but trying to talk about movement and physical activity differently with our young people. Step seven's about social media and building community. Step eight is about sustaining self-care practices and how to cultivate that in families. Step nine is one of my favorites. It's about teaching young people that feelings are safe and that emotions are commonplace and part of human experience. And then step 10 is a bit of a summary step where the focus is on whole self and embodiment and how to work with that with children. So obviously they're not linear steps. They're just sort of interconnected steps. And they're just things that I have found to be useful in the work that I've done with individuals and families around cultivating a healthy and really nourishing relationship with one's body and self and food.
Yeah. So let's dig into each of those a little bit, or not, won't get to all of them, but I have some questions about specific steps that I'd love to dive into. The first is, why is it important for parents to ditch dieting for both themselves and their kids? And how can parents approach that when they're struggling with their own issues with food and body?
That is such an important question. And I think I want to say first and foremost that I really worked hard as I wrote this book to both toe the line between having some authority around this from my, you know, almost 30 years in the field, and also being a parent who has a lot of compassion around how hard it is for us as parents to actually be the role models that we want to be for our kids. It's not easy. Even if we have lots of knowledge, it's still not always easy. So I want to put that out there. But yes, I think the most important thing that we can do as parents is just keep doing our own work to take care of ourselves and our bodies in the ways that we know to be best for us. And then we will be setting that standard for our kids who are always watching us, sometimes more closely than we think they are. So if we are dieting, for example, or engaging in behavior that's diet-oriented, children are more likely to notice that and maybe copy that behavior. Or they're also likely to be confused because, well, for example, if there's a food that they absolutely love and it feels so good in their bodies to eat it, and then they hear from a parent, well, that food is bad or you shouldn't eat so much of it. It can just be really confusing for a young mind to wrap themselves around the idea that this food that feels so good in my body could be bad for me. They're not able to think about it in the adult way. So confusion can kind of ensue, and that's obviously difficult.
Yeah. And that can lead to like disconnection from their body too, right? Of disconnecting from what feels pleasurable and good to them, or the feelings of satisfaction that come with eating foods they love.
Absolutely. That's ultimately what we want for ourselves, is to be in our bodies more and make decisions from that place. And so the way to encourage that in our kids is to model that. Easier said than done.
Right. Totally. I mean, I really appreciate how you acknowledge your own struggles with this throughout the book, that you are someone who has all this expertise as a food and nutrition therapist and a long history of recovery from your own eating disorder. And yet you still had moments where you said things or did things that your daughters later were like, oh, that wasn't so great, Mom. And, you know, you own it in the book. And I think that really goes a long way toward making this book feel like not shaming toward parents. And I think that's super important, because as a relatively new parent myself, haven't really delved into a lot of parenting literature because I know so much of it is bogus and is also going to like harm my mental health and take me away from what I sort of know in my core values to be true and how I want to raise my daughter. And also like the books that I have read or the social media stuff that I have come across or parenting articles that I've read often do have this kind of shaming tone and this feeling of like, oh my God, I'm doing it wrong. And I think that's just like anathema to so many parents, and so many parents want to get away from that feeling. And I think your book has a nice tone that sort of makes it more useful actually to parents.
I'm so happy to hear you say that, because that was definitely intentional. I really worked hard on that, and I had lots of parents read it to make sure that it did feel that way, because that was my aim. And we're not perfect, like, nor do our children want us to be perfect, because wow, that's really hard to live up to, right? So I think I was very happy to share some of my own foibles around these topics, because I think we all do it. We all may say like something disparaging about our bodies, for instance, or do the thing like I did where I chased my kids out the door with their breakfast. And then we realize, well, wait, like I'm in their lane and I'm not really supposed to be doing this. And I really know better. Like I've had all this training and I've done all this eating disorders work. And I really know I'm not supposed to move over into their own lane. And I'm still struggling with it. And if I can still struggle with it, then of course, people reading this book are likely to be struggling with it at times too. And so I hope that does make it feel like, okay, we're all trying to work on the same things here. And we're all just trying to like be a better culture for our kids. And we're not always going to get it right 100% of the time. And it's okay.
Yeah, I think that's so hugely important. One story that really struck me that I think is kind of like an outlier type of story, but I think has something instructive maybe to give, is the story of the mom who thought she was keeping her bulimic behaviors a secret, but then she overheard her daughter talking about them to a friend. And I found the mom's response to that really moving. Could you share a little bit about that story?
Yeah. My client was really surprised that her young child knew about her purging behaviors, like was aware, because it was something that she did in secret. And when she heard her child telling someone, oh, my mom also eats ice cream and then throws up afterwards, she just became so moved by that statement that she heard her child say that she very quickly afterwards went up to her child and said, look, mommy has an eating disorder. Mommy has a problem with food. And that throwing up that you talked about is not okay. And it's not something that is healthy. And I'm really getting help in trying to work on this. And I want you to know that. And she also actually amazingly stopped the behavior immediately. It's so interesting that like what she had been working on for some time was so much easier to halt when she knew that it was affecting her child. Maybe her child wasn't yet affected by it, but that her child was even aware of it.
Yeah, because I think we don't realize sometimes what kids pick up on. And I think one of the things I found so powerful about that story is that she took responsibility without falling into self-blame, which I think is a hard line to walk, right? I think that's also the compassion that you bring to the story. But it sounds like that was her experience as well, that she didn't get stuck in this self-blame place that made her unable to move and act. She realized what was going on and took responsibility and also had compassion for herself. I'm curious how you think parents can walk that line. You know, if there's anyone listening who has an eating disorder or disordered eating and is struggling with that while also trying to raise a kid with a positive relationship with food in their body, how can parents walk that line of taking responsibility and maybe own what's going on for them or with their kids in an age-appropriate way while also having self-compassion without tumbling into self-blame?
Yeah, it's such a good question. I really think that it's probably best not to say much about one's recovery work unless you hear about it from your child in some way. Obviously, you know, your work is your work and the children don't need to be aware of every bit of it, nor should they. But in this case, for example, where the young person really saw and heard something that was confusing for them, or actually they were sort of matter of fact about it because they had heard it multiple times, that's when it's appropriate to step in and say, actually, this thing that mommy's doing is not something that I would encourage you to do. It's something that actually is really hard and I'm getting some help with. And then obviously the key is do your good work that you're doing in treatment, like work on that. If that shame voice is coming up, which I'm sure it did at times for my client, get support for that so that you are able to create those lessons in the moment with your children.
Yeah. Let's talk about some things that parents do for their kids sort of in the name of health or thinking that they're helping them that might actually be harmful to their relationship with food, which I think, again, can bring up so much shame and self-blame. And so we need to really have a spirit of compassion toward those things, but also kind of know and understand the repercussions. So one thing that you talk about in the book is parents putting kids on gluten-free, dairy-free diets or other elimination diets in the name of health, doing it from a well-intentioned place because they've probably seen so much media about the supposed problems with these foods. And you know, there's so much out there in diet and wellness culture demonizing those kinds of foods. And so they want to do what's best for their kids. But what actually happens when kids get put on these quote unquote allergy diets when they don't actually have genuine food allergies?
I'm glad you're asking this question. It is such a delicate question because I don't ever believe that a parent is trying to create a harmful situation. In fact, that usually when someone is manipulating their kids eating in any way, they're trying to just give them what they believe to be healthy and good for them. That said, if there's no life-threatening or life-limiting effects from the elimination diet that the child can recognize, then it can be really confusing to not be able to eat what all the other kids are eating. It's one thing if you know that you get an itchy tongue or a rash or there's some other significant issue from the food, but it's another thing if the child doesn't have that kind of outcome when they eat it. It can just be really confusing. And of course, they're going to go along with what their parent says is important for them. They'll follow that restrictive diet for a while because the parent is their authority. But once the child starts to have a little bit more authority over their choices, that's when I have seen the most challenges. All of a sudden, the child is going over to their friend's house more, and those foods that had been forbidden for a while are now more accessible to them. And they often have a lot of charge around those foods and then can't manage them when they are out in social settings. Or maybe they make a decision as a family, like the example that I have in my book, to let go of that way of eating. And they bring the gluten and dairy or whatever it is that's been eliminated back, it can be just really hard for that young person to manage the emotional sort of attachment to those foods that they haven't had in so long. And, you know, obviously it can be ridden out and worked on, but the reality is that it can actually create a more challenging relationship with those foods than if they hadn't done the elimination diet to begin with.
Life's better with American Family Insurance. Because we know in making the most of your home, DIY doesn't just stand for do it yourself. It also means dream it yourself. And we're here to help protect the dreams you're building. Save up to 23% when you bundle home and auto. American Family Insurance. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Another thing that parents, I think, will try to prevent their kids from having is sugar, right? That is a huge one in this culture. And I know many parents struggle with it. There's so much messaging out there that sugar is bad and toxic for kids, or that they're going to be out of control with it. And I think even parents who have a very good relationship with food and are intuitive eaters and all that stuff can struggle with, like, what are appropriate limits to set around sugar. I know even I'm like, my daughter really likes ice cream and we give her dessert with dinner, and sometimes we'll do ice cream, sometimes we'll do cookies, sometimes we'll do whatever, you know, different things. Sometimes it's like fruit or whatever, you know, but if she's asking for ice cream like every single night, I'm like, you know, sometimes I found myself being like, oh, we don't have any right now, you know, just so that I'm like not giving her the same thing all the time. But then I just struggle, you know, is this some diet culture stuff coming up for me? What's going on here? What are appropriate limits to set? So I really appreciated what you wrote in the book about that, about like setting limits in a way that is not restrictive. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I think the key with setting limits of any kind with children, actually, but food is in here and that's what we're talking about. The key to setting limits of any kind is consistency and sort of nonchalance about it. So if you were to say, we're not having ice cream tonight, but maybe we will in a couple of days. You know, just like, that's not what we're having tonight, but we'll have some soon. Just like in a very nonchalant and reasonable way, so that everybody is under the same umbrella of that limit. That's the most important thing. When I think families have gotten into some trouble with food, as I've seen it in my practice, is when one family member has a different rule about sweets than the other, or like, the boys are able to eat differently than the girls, which all genders should be able to eat similarly in a family. Or when the children are given limits around sweets, but then they witness a parent eating the thing that they're not allowed to have, for example. So the bottom line is consistency in general. And I'm a really big fan of having as little limits as possible when it comes to food. I really try to have nothing was off limits in my house. And that worked for us. And my kids had a very diverse palate and relationship with food and never really had a lot of charts around certain foods. So it worked well for me, but I'm aware that all families are different. And sometimes the charge around sweet foods comes in young and early, and it may be related to the environment or not. And some limits are reasonable. We wouldn't bring a child into a candy store and say, you can eat everything in the store. We would say, we're going to walk into the store and here's $2, or here's a little bag and you can fill it up. So teaching reasonable limits around anything is really helpful. It's part of our job as parents. But the key is consistency and reasonableness, and that like limits are flexible too. You know, maybe usually you don't as a family do this one thing, but today it's like, we're going to do something different. So they can also be flexible. And I think that's really important messaging for kids.
Yeah, I think that's so helpful. And just the idea of, we're having this tonight and maybe we'll have this other thing tomorrow, is such a helpful framing too. I think I try to do that and be nonchalant about it, but there's this sort of nagging feeling in my head of, oh, I'm doing it wrong or whatever. But because I think we all want to, as an anti-diet dietitian, I want to have total openness and freedom and flexibility with food. But I also want, I guess, variety and to expose my daughter to different things and not have her sort of get stuck on one food that becomes the only thing she ever wants to eat, which is a tricky thing right now because she is so picky anyway. And we're trying to just have different things at each meal just to kind of get it to not have other than a few things that are like her go-tos, which we'll have, but then we have other things that are different around that. Yeah, but I'm finding that the sort of lack of diversity in her desires is a challenge for me right now.
Of course. I know all too well that feeling of overthinking things just because we are anti-diet dietitians. So I totally get that. And pickiness is one of those things that really like tugs at our heartstrings too, because you're providing this food, this nourishment for your child and they don't want it. And so it's hard not to have like a personal or emotional response to that too. Obviously, we want the best for our kids and we know that diversity in the diet is like ideal from a, you know, nutritional standpoint, but yet we also can't force a child to try new things. We can only make suggestions or continue to make the foods available, continue to give them opportunities to try them or touch them or smell them or be in the kitchen with them. We can't like really create a eater who loves a diversity of foods. Like they have to go at their own time. And some kids are just more adventurous and some kids are much more cautious. And it's hard to like sit back as a parent and respect that individual difference of the child and respect their autonomy around it when we kind of quote unquote know better. But it's so critical. And it's critical. And I have so much solidarity around how hard it is to do that as a parent.
Yeah. It's a tricky balance. And I think for me, the stuff about allowing all foods and not restricting or having any sort of limits on how much a child can eat comes pretty easily, you know, other than this one thing about like, I don't want you to have ice cream every single time. We can have other desserts. It's not even a thing about sugar, really. It's just a thing about variety. That's kind of my hang up, that easy to like let everything be on limits, but I find it hard. And you talk in one chapter about this, about the like encouragement to eat as a way that parents can unwittingly interfere in their child's relationship with food. And that's the thing that I think I struggle with because of the pickiness, because I'm like, can you just eat some food and can you just eat some variety? I know that overall, over time, the variety balances out and it's not a big deal. She only has, you know, one type of food for a couple of days and another type of food, and that it all kind of comes out in the wash within a week. And just encouraging food consumption in general, I think, is something that I struggle with. And I try not to do it and don't want to interfere. But, you know, there's moments where, oh, you're really all done? Do you want this? And it's tough, too, because sometimes she says all done and then she eats more. You know, she's like literally putting food in her mouth as she's saying all done. So it can be a challenge from that perspective, too.
Absolutely. That's why I tell the story about how I chased my daughters out the door with breakfast. Because even I know that that's like not what we're supposed to be doing, but I did it anyway, because we think as parents, we in some ways know what's good for our kids. You know, I know that like my kids are going to crash midway through their morning at school if they don't have a good breakfast, but they sort of need to figure that out for themselves, especially as, you know, this is an older child moment that I talk about. You know, they kind of have to figure that out for themselves over time. But when they're little, of course, you want to encourage diversity. You want to encourage them to be comfortable with food. And I think keeping it as light and no pressure as possible really is all you can do in that situation. And know that like picky eating is often just part of development. And it's often a cautious time or a time when there's some sensory development that feels like a little overwhelming for the child. And it usually goes away. These like food jags and pickiness that happen, you know, most adults aren't eating all white foods, but some children do get stuck and don't thrive and develop ARFID, for example, and that's separate and different and does need to be addressed. But most garden variety picky eating that we encounter in our homes really does go away over time, particularly if we don't make too much of it, if we don't have too much of an emotional response that then the child somehow needs to exert their independence around.
Mm-hmm, right. It becomes a way to rebel.
Right.
And a way they know they can get a rise out of you.
Yeah. Or maybe not necessarily rebel, because like when a toddler doesn't like really understand that yet, when they're older, they definitely do. But a toddler is more like they just want to like do it themselves. They want to make their decisions themselves. So if they feel a parent encouraging them towards broccoli, it's going to make them back off more, especially if they're already feeling cautious about broccoli to begin with, because it's got a weird texture. So being nonchalant and light about offering that variety and not getting too upset when things are touched versus not touched, doing some encouragement around, let's all try one new food we've never tried before today. I'm going to try something that I've never tried. What about you? Or would this be a day that would be a good day for you to try something new? And if they say no, then pick your battles and let it go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I also think it is a matter of time and patience. And, you know, there are certain things that she used to love eating when she was a baby that she now won't touch. And we're like, okay, cool, whatever. Like, we try giving it in different forms. Maybe she'll accept it. She used to love cheddar cheese just straight out of the fridge, slices crumbled up, obviously. And then she started hating it. Now she'll eat it if it's like cooked into little like cheddar cheese chips. So we'll do that sometimes. We'll be like, ooh, they're crunchy chips. And we don't really mention that it's cheese and it's not a thing and she's fine. But then yesterday, my husband was putting a slice of cheddar cheese on his burger. And my daughter was like, want some cheese? And then we're like, oh, okay. And she's like, Noah eats cheese. This is her friend at school, you know? And then all of a sudden it's like a cool thing to do because her friend does it. I think that social element plays a role there too.
It's huge, actually. Very often kids who are picky will try different things at their friend's houses. And, you know, it's just a different environment. And often there's no dynamic around it. So it makes it easier. And, you know, how cool is that she's opening up and wanting to try something that she'd been feeling a little sheepish about? That's great. And that's like kind of how it rolls with food, kit and kids. They kind of like go in and out of liking certain things, not liking certain things. There's so many other aspects of development that are like bumpy and just like that. But I think food preferences are like that too. They shift, they morph, and they twist. And I think we just have to appreciate that's the unique experience of the child and not get too upset about it. As long as they're like growing and thriving in general, then you probably can back off and just be an observer around it.
Mm-hmm. Let that ebb and flow mm-hmm. as they grow.
So hard to do, though. Like, I just want to add that it's really hard to do as a parent, especially a nutrition professional parent, to just let it go. So,
yeah, no, as chill as we can be. I mean, I think I'm a pretty chill parent overall. And I know from your book and just your general vibe, you seem like a pretty chill parent too. And your kids even said, Mom, you're so chill. It drives me nuts, you know, whatever. But even then, like, even the chillest parent can have a really hard time with this stuff.
Totally. Absolutely. I have my moments of not being so chill too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Same, of course.
And I've had to work on that too. In some way, like my nervous system is not naturally super chill. So I have to do my work on my end to stay regulated so I can give them a nice, safe place to land when they're feeling dysregulated.
Yeah, same. I definitely has not come naturally to me to be a chill parent or to be a chill person in general, to have a chill vibe that I project. Although I think I did learn early on to like hide my true feelings and project a neutral vibe. So there's probably that part of it too. But inside, you know, sometimes I'm roiling with anxiety, but you wouldn't necessarily know it on the surface.
Sure. Yeah, I can relate to that. And I think like it's actually okay to not always be chill too as parents. One of my chapters is about emotions. Like, we want our kids to have full emotional expression. And it doesn't mean that we're doormats, though, as parents, and we let our kids be in charge. We still want to set reasonable limits to keep them safe and teach them how to respect other people and be respectful of others. But like, in general, it's really good for us to just be real. And if we have a response, an emotional response, for example, that is something that we wish that we didn't have, we go back and we say, you know, I wish that I had spoken to you a little bit more gently about that. I'm sorry that I didn't. I was really upset and the words came out in a way that I don't feel good about. So I just wanted to let you know I'm sorry. That does amazing work on teaching them about, you know, rupture and repair in relationships. Just that little bit.
You know, I've seen a lot of parenting trends, like the big parenting trend now is gentle parenting. And this idea that in some of the more militant applications of it, and also some of the watered down applications that you'll see on social media, it's like there are all these scripts and you're supposed to just be this parent robot who does the script perfectly and shows no emotion and doesn't have any sort of reactions of your own. And of course, that's like not realistic for anyone. And of course, parents are going to have reactions and there's no need to feel guilty or ashamed about that. And I think too, the way that gentle parenting can sometimes get twisted is that you need to be all about the emotion. You know, gentle parenting is like about validating emotions and telling kids that it's okay to have emotions and that's all great. But I think sometimes people can go in this direction of like only validating emotions and not also setting the boundaries. Because I think the full expression really needs to be yeah, I see that you're frustrated. I understand. I'd be frustrated too. And it's not okay to hit. I won't let you hit. We need to move away until you feel like you can be there without hitting or whatever it might be.
Yeah, boundaries are so valuable too. Some of what we teach by example.
Yeah, learning to set your own boundaries and set boundaries with the child in a way that's affirming still to who they are, I think is a real skill.
It is. And it's not easy in the moment when you're feeling a little dysregulated yourself because your kid's freaking out or something's happening that's stressing you out. So I have a lot of compassion around that. And you know, we're all like learning and growing together around this stuff. That's like hopefully what I was trying to communicate in my writing, that our like striving is so wonderful for our kids to see. If we are striving to just be our best selves and also like be human beings on a path of growth, I think that's like a wonderful thing to demonstrate to a kid. And we don't have to get it perfect. Again, nobody wants perfect parents to have to live up to.
Right, exactly. That creates its own problems, right? If you're too perfect. And the kids can never understand. I think there is that idea of the good enough parent, right? That like you give them some sort of disappointment to learn from. And not that you're intentionally disappointing your kids, but just we will disappoint them. We will fail to meet their needs in some ways. And that's okay. And that's actually an important part of development. If we could be quote unquote perfect and never disappoint them or fail to meet their needs, that actually wouldn't be helpful for their resilience or their growth.
Absolutely. I'm right there with you.
Let's talk about the issues with categorizing food as good or bad, and even euphemisms that, again, I see a lot on social media, like growing food versus extra food, or work food versus play food, or like does a lot versus does a little. And I think, you know, parents do this from a place of love, right? And a place of trying to support their kids' well-being and not say good and bad. And that's great. That's an important effort to be making. And those kinds of categories can be problematic, right? So let's talk about like why categorizing food in general is not something we might want to do and what we could do instead.
I'm happy you brought this up because I do think all of those seemingly less harmful categories are still categories. And saying this is a growing food and you have to eat this first before you can eat the treat food, that's like what I'm hearing probably the most is, I think that like is challenging because then it again sets up certain foods to be more valuable than others. And again, it can be confusing to young kids who don't actually have a hierarchy around food usually. They might understand like some things taste better to them than other things, but there's no morality usually in young children around food. And so putting food into categories introduces this idea of morality with food, which is just not necessary. I think we want kids to grow up appreciating that food comes in lots of different shapes and sizes and smells and colors, and that it doesn't mean that we don't teach about balance to children when they're old enough to really take that in. When they're old enough, saying thinking like middle school, maybe a little before. But young kids, particularly those who don't really have any interest in nutrition science, which is most of them, really don't need to like learn about nutrition and what has protein and what doesn't and what has more vitamins than other things. They really just don't need to categorize food in any way. What they need most to do is learn how to self-regulate on their own, to learn how to sort of eat to fuel their hunger and their activity in their bodies, and then notice when they've had enough and they're not as interested in food and they want to play something else. It's really about being in their body and experiencing food, as opposed to you introduce a category or a label and then it brings kids right out of their bodies and into a sort of more of a mind kind of choice around foods. Well, mom says I should be eating this. And so I'm going to either eat more of it or I'm going to eat less of it, depending on the developmental stage of the child, as opposed to like, my body feels like eating more of this.
And I think it's really helpful to talk about like developmentally appropriate ways to approach nutrition, because those are very limited, actually, as you say in the book, and really only appropriate for older kids. And yet schools are teaching this stuff so young, right? And I'm dreading the day that my daughter's daycare starts teaching her about nutrition, because the owner kind of seems like she has that vibe a little bit. And, you know, I'm curious what you think are some developmentally appropriate ways that schools can talk about nutrition with kids, and how do we know when they're doing it in a way that might potentially be harmful, or what we can do to sort of set a boundary with schools or care providers or other adults in the child's life when they start talking about nutrition with our kids in ways that we don't feel are appropriate?
Well, that's such a hard one. But I do think it makes sense if you have a regular care provider or a school system who's willing to listen, to sort of talk about the way you like to approach food with your kids and give them the evidence base behind it. In general, children just need to be given balanced, appropriate, diverse meals on a regular basis from their care providers, and then be left to eat what feels right in their bodies in the moment. I really believe that to be the best way to approach food with young people. I think when we start to interject too much direction or education around shoulds and shouldn'ts, then it just gets really confusing for kids. And I do think that we have to change the way we teach about nutrition. And we also have to encourage self-esteem and body image oriented education in the curriculum at the same time we're talking about food, right? And we're just not there yet, unfortunately, in most systems, most school systems. But I do think that actually less is more when it comes to nutrition education for young people.
Do you think there's a place for parents to ask if their kids can do some sort of different activity while the nutrition lesson is going on, or advocate for removing it for all kids? What do you think makes sense?
Yeah, that's a great question. I just don't know. I think it probably depends on the individual school system in terms of what's possible. I know a colleague of mine who actually went in, she's obviously a nutrition therapist who does similar work as you and I, and she went in and actually worked with the school on revising the curriculum and doing some different teaching. Not everyone is able to do that or has the time and ability to do that, but I think it's worth putting some information out there. And I do have some resources in my book, and they're on the web too, of how to talk to schools about weighing, for example, or when calories are discussed. There's some templates that are in, and I'm happy to give you the actual resource so that you have it for your listeners too.
That would be great. Yeah, we can put that in the show notes.
Yeah, that can be useful for folks who are navigating this. My kids are in college now, so I haven't had these discussions in recent times. So I don't actually even know all of what's going on in the school systems these days. I think that's very different depending on the system.
I know schools are supposed to have some sort of curriculum about health and wellness, but how much that involves nutrition is probably up to the individual school. Maybe there's state by state regulations on that too.
Yeah. And I just would love to have more stress management and discussion of healthy body image and self-esteem and emotions in those health and wellness classes versus nutrition. And I'm not saying that we don't provide good nutrition for our kids. I'm not saying that at all. Someone joked that I'm the person who's saying we all have to eat processed food, or we have to give processed food to our kids. And it's just not that simple, although I don't demonize processed food of any type either. The bottom line is, unless you're milking the cow in your backyard, everything's processed on some level. But in general, I wanted to make available good, balanced, healthy, diverse nutrition for my kids. And that's what I did. And I tried to make food fun and accessible and interesting and colorful. But that's an adult role. And the kids don't need to get involved in that until they're much older and they're doing much more of that self-selection of food. When they're little, we provide and they make choices out of that diversity that we provide for them. And I think that's really the best way to approach food. As they get older and they have questions about food, as questions about how their bodies work and how the food works in their bodies, those are the times that we can interject a little nutrition education. But it shouldn't be about wellness, because you and I both know that bodies are so unique and different, and what's well for one body in terms of diet and nutrition could be very different in another body. So the focus should really be on diversity in our diets and taking good care of ourselves, and not so much about trying to ward off diseases, which I think is just confusing for young people to take in.
Yeah, it's all very abstract and hard to process, and scary too, right? It can feel really scary to think about some connection between what you eat and something that's going to harm your body. I think kids are very black and white. And so those kinds of messages get translated into this food is bad, this food is good, like this food is going to kill you, this food is going to make you get heart disease and therefore die or something.
Right. Whereas like really what kids best would learn about food, I think, is like, oh, when I eat a good breakfast, it makes me run faster. Or when I eat a bigger snack, then I focus on my homework better. That kind of stuff. Like, I think the importance of food is important to teach on some level, that like food actually helps you through your day. To me, that's the most important message for young people.
To do that in age-appropriate ways probably means we don't teach that very young, right? That's again, like for kids that are older and starting to think about how their bodies work and maybe a little bit more open to that, or in science classes and learning about things that are related.
Yes, if they have questions about it, then certainly. But for the most part, little ones, they just want to talk about their preferences when it comes to food. They don't really want to talk about anything science related. It's too abstract.
Let's talk a little bit about pleasure and why, when you're in your chapter about nutrition, you really emphasize pleasure and put it even over and above nutrition as being important for our well-being.
Well, I think that our kids are going to get lots of nutrition information from the internet when they become exposed to the internet, which is younger and younger. And so I think the more nonchalant and pleasure-oriented we can be around food, better. And I think making food fun and also making like balanced, healthy eating fun, I think is important. You know, we do a lot of teaching in our kitchen if we're someone who's inclined to be the food preparer of the family, when we get kids involved in putting a meal together and kind of show them what it looks like to create a meal. We don't have to talk about protein and carbohydrates and fats and all of that. We just have to play with our kids in the kitchen in some way, and they learn a little bit about what balance looks like. So I think keeping it light, keeping it focused on pleasure and enjoyment and getting together as a family and sharing food is, I think, part of what makes food fun for kids. And hopefully they'll have a more diverse palate and they'll be more open to different foods when they can be more involved in the process and it's actually fun.
Speaking of when they get on the internet, one of the steps in your book is to discuss social media and build community, which I love because I've been doing a lot of research for my work on wellness culture to look at how wellness misinformation and disinformation spreads and the role of social media in that and in sort of radicalizing us and exposing us to more and more extreme diet and wellness content, leading people down these rabbit holes. And that can ultimately lead to really toxic forms of misinformation, not just about food and weight stuff, but also about vaccines and other things, you know, public health matters. So I think talking to kids about social media and having boundaries around social media is super important. And regulation of social media, I think, is super important as well at the policy level. How do you recommend parents talk to kids about social media and what boundaries should we consider setting on it?
I think that it really depends on your family. I'd never set up rules for families that I work with around this, but I think it's very individual. Personally, I think the longer you can keep kids away from social media, the better. But eventually it's inevitable. And I think having reasonable limits around it that everyone in the family can comply with absolutely makes sense. And that means the adults actually too, potentially, especially if you're going to be seen using social media in your house. You want to be consistent with your guidelines for the young people and your own behaviors with it. But what I highlighted the most in this chapter is what I think is a bomb against social media, because I don't think social media and like the internet are going to go away. I think that those messages, disinformation and misinformation are going to be out there, sadly. I love the advocacy work that you and others are doing around this, Christy, but I think unfortunately it's not going away anytime soon. So I feel like what we can do as families is really create community around our kids that is supportive so that they have other people to go to ask questions about something that they may see on social media, for example, that seems a little funny, or they might bounce something that they saw on social media off one of their community members. Parents are definitely part of that community, but I think it's also great to have lots of other adults, maybe some teens that you trust and bring into your household to like actually be supportive connection points for our children that are outside of social media influencers. It's like you create your own little set of influencers around your children, if that makes sense. Not because you're trying to influence per se, because obviously our kids have to grow and experience the world in their own way, but that you have good people around them who can counteract some of that stuff that's out there that is not really about them. You know, it's sort of like real love versus all those social media likes. And you create as much real love around your child as possible. And I think that can be a really helpful bomb. And it may not totally protect your child from everything that's out there. There's no way that you can do that, but at least it gives them some people to talk to so that if something they see or read is really confusing or traumatic or distressing in some way, they have people to talk to.
Yeah. It makes me think a little bit about the discourse around processed foods and how there are some people who advocate just totally banning them or keeping them out of your household and, you know, not engaging with processed foods in any way. And similarly, there's some people who advocate really strict limits around social media or screens. And I think it's unrealistic in both of those cases, right, to have this sort of wholesale ban on these things, especially as kids get older. You know, certainly when they're young, you can keep them away from those things. But as they're aging into like middle and high school, they're going to be exposed in some ways too. And so helping them learn like reasonable ways of engaging, or even if you're not, I mean, I personally also think that as long as I can wait to give social media to my daughter, and who knows what it's going to be like when she's in her teens, but hopefully we will have some better regulations on things by then. But I think even as much as I want to wait, I also want to help her have a critical relationship with it and a skeptical and thoughtful relationship with it if she does encounter it from a friend or, you know, at someone's house or whatever. So versus a wholesale ban that I think can make, like you said, you know, in terms of processed food or other kinds of foods that are off limits, can make kids feel totally like unhinged around the food when they're exposed to it at a friend's house or out in the world. And, you know, I think regulations do play a role when it comes to social media and keeping kids safe, keeping everyone safe, honestly, protecting our mental health and our public health and stuff like that. But I also think the parallel with food, where it's like kids are well nourished and satisfied and don't have anything off limits and aren't sort of in this deprived relationship with food, then they can generally handle themselves a lot better around foods that are deemed quote unquote processed or ultra processed. They don't have that same kind of compulsive feeling around those foods. And I think perhaps similarly with social media, when kids are generally well resourced with community and friendships and like offline connections and sources of information they can go to that are in the real world and have validity and people they trust, they probably have less of a need to turn to social media and those kinds of incentives and relationships that exist there.
Absolutely. I think that was so well said. It's really about balance in all things, but definitely I think when it comes to social media, keeping the lines of communication open so that when your child starts to become introduced to social media, you're just asking them, like, I'm curious about what kinds of things are you finding interesting? Being curious, like not critical, but curious about it. Oh, and how does it make you feel when you look at that? That's a big one. How does it make you feel, you know, when you take a look at something on social media, to help them think critically about what they're choosing and not choosing to look at. And, you know, I think as they get older, they'll like understand a little bit more. You know, one of my daughters was home from college and was like, Mom, I'm working on a paper and I want you to take my phone like you used to when we were kids. She's like, where's the bowl? Because I used to have this bowl that we put the phones in, like, okay, the phone's in the bowl time. You know, she's like, where's that bowl? She's like, will you take it? And if I ask for it, will you not give it to me? And it was kind of funny. It was almost like she knew, she had the self-awareness to know that it was kind of addictive, like psychologically addictive. And she wanted to get her paper done. So just interesting. You know, when they get older, they can regulate around that a little bit more, or they might even ask you for help. So I thought that was a sweet example of like, okay, she got it. She hated when I took the bowl out when they were kids. And she did not like it when that bowl came out. But now she kind of gets why the bowl came out.
And that probably wouldn't have been the case if the limit was so strict that she felt the need to like completely go the other way.
Right. We tried to keep social media away as long as possible, but there is a point at which it then makes them very different than the other children around them. And there needs to be some kind of access so they can learn how to manage it, just like you said earlier. And so having some limits, and we often would sit down and talk about it. So what do you think is an appropriate amount of time to be on, you know, your phone? Like, what do you think? Like, when do you think it's okay to have your phone out? And they would say, not after school when I'm trying to do my homework, or not after what time at night? Or, you know, we would make these decisions together when they were old enough to be a part of that discussion when they were teens. And that was really helpful. And even preteens, I believe, because that's when they got their first phone. And we kind of came up with those guidelines together, and then we would adjust them if it wasn't working.
That sounds great. It's really helpful to also have them be a part of the decision-making and not feel like it's just being imposed on them.
Absolutely. Especially for older kids. As you're entering adolescence, agency is so important, which is why I think food gets kind of thrown in there at times. When someone feels like maybe there's some things that are out of their control in their very changing lives. But I think giving them some agency in those decisions doesn't mean that you give them free rein with the phone because they say they should have it. Obviously, working together to come up with some guidelines makes sense.
Well, thank you, Heidi, for everything you shared. This is a really great book. I'm excited for people to check it out and learn more about your work. Can you tell them where they can do that, where they can find you online and find your book?
Yeah, thank you. I am at anourishingword.com. So that's anourishingword, WORD.com. And you can find my book there. Authors always love it when you buy directly from them, but it's also on bookshop.org. It's available in all bookstores and libraries. You just have to ask for it. It's available on all the platforms as well. And the name of the book is Nurture: How to Raise Kids Who Love Food, Their Bodies, and Themselves.
Amazing. We'll put links to that in the show notes so people can find it. Thank you again. This was a great conversation.
Thank you so much for having me, Christy. I really appreciate it.
So that's our show. Thanks again to our guests for being here, and thanks to you for listening. If you found this podcast helpful, I'd be so grateful if you take a moment to subscribe, rate, and review it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. You can see all the places to subscribe at ChristyHarrison.com/subscribe. That's ChristyHarrison.com/subscribe. If you're looking for help healing your own relationship with food, grab my free audio guide, 7 Simple Strategies for Finding Peace and Freedom with Food. Just go to ChristyHarrison.com/strategies to get it. That's ChristyHarrison.com/strategies. To get full show notes and a transcript of this episode, go to ChristyHarrison.com/foodpsych. And to get the transcript, find the episode page and scroll down to the bottom to enter your email address. A big thanks to Softer Sounds for audio editing and production, and to administrative assistant Julianne Witasik for helping me out with all the moving parts that go into producing this show. Our album art was photographed by Abby Moore Photography, and the logo was designed by Melissa Alam. Our theme song was written and performed by Carolyn Pennypacker Riggs, and I'm your host and executive producer, Christy Harrison. Thanks again for listening, and until next time, stay psyched.
Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free, at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.